You are listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. And what have we got today, Hannah?
Today's article comes from the Pondere News from August 20th of 1892. Representative Herman says that he expects it will be some time before the Klamath Indian Reservation will be open to settlement. The preliminary steps are now being taken. The land must first be surveyed, and then the Indians are given 6 months to make their selections of allotments. And the land will then be thrown open to settlement under the homestead laws only. All but the mountainous regions will be surveyed, and the unsurveyed portion will be set aside for all the Indians. The lands will then be disposed of under the land laws of the United States, which means under the homestead, mineral, and timberland laws. Any person who has ever perfected his homestead right will not be entitled to enter under the law. But if it has never been perfected, he may enter 160 acres of land and prove up after residing 14 months upon the tract. The homestead settler must pay $1.50 an acre for the land. It is the intention to survey only the agricultural lands first. Then the president's proclamation will be issued, and the Indian selections must be made within 6 months after the proclamation has been issued, after which the white men will have a chance. White men may select lands, but during the first 6 months, the Indians can remove him.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm joined here, as always, by Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, Director Emeritus of the museum. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
That is quite an article. Lot to talk about there, and I guess we're going to dive into the topic of homesteading in today's show. But we must ask, why is today's newspaper article about Southern Oregon instead of North Idaho?
Well, this is a case where we can learn a lot thinking about who the intended audience of this article was. So this article is from 1892, one of the earliest papers issued in Bonner County. But it was published about a decade after trains came through Sandpoint and the population began to boom. So by 1892, there were many people who had already filed homestead claims here in Bonner County, and many people who were probably realizing just how hard it was to cut a living in the rugged Idaho terrain. For people reading this article who had failed at homesteading in Idaho, the prospect of available land in Oregon would have likely become welcome news. After all, most people originally heading west on the Oregon Trail as early as 1840s were in pursuit of these fabled farmlands.
Well, did I hear correctly that the opening up in lands from the Klamath they were opening up lands from the reservation, the Klamath Reservation? And wasn't that land already set aside for the tribe?
Yes, you did hear that correctly. By the 1890s, we were nearing the end of the period of history now known as westward expansion. And during that time, treaties between the U.S. government and Western tribes were created, some were broken, and many were renegotiated. Periodically, the reservations were reduced in size or otherwise made available through legislation such as the General Allocation or the Dawes Act of 1887. So what might originally be negotiated as, say, a million-acre reservation for a tribe could later be cut down to 200,000 acres, even 20,000 acres, based on a variety of factors. But especially as the West was opening up and valuable, desirable natural resources were discovered on those lands, that could play a factor in those renegotiations. Hmm.
Were the tribes really given the first choice of the land, as the article suggests there? That they had like a 6 month window before?
Yes, legally.
Okay.
But let's go back a bit and mm-hmm. we'll set up the framework for the Homestead Act and how it exactly worked.
Yeah. So free land was the cry when the Homestead Act was enacted in 1862 by the Lincoln administration. The eastern part of the U.S. was becoming crowded by the standards of the day, not as we would think of it today. And the country embraced expansion into westward lands. Of course, the land labeled free for the taking was at the time occupied by millennia-old nations of Native Americans. One thing that you kind of have to understand is that the Homestead Act was not only sending more people west, but it was also imposing this kind of ideology or concept even of boundaries and borders onto people who considered land ownership a community commodity rather than an individual one. So, yes, at that time there were tribes that were, you know, kind of had rough territories, you know, so like one tribe would live on this side of a mountain range and one would live on the other, but there weren't these like lines on the ground that had to be honored the way that the European settlers kind of understood property ownership. Over the course of the next century, most Native Americans were displaced from their homelands and kind of forced onto reservations. And the tribes that were impacted locally by this type of thing and by the Homestead Act were the Kalispell, Kootenai, and Coeur d'Alene tribes primarily.
Yeah.
Well, I always find that just that, you know, we grow up, most of us in this country, just sort of like understanding property boundaries in such a certain way, and the idea of that, but that is that's just a cultural construct.
Or
that's
even not, you know, we grew up learning the 50 states and like these are the states and these are their shapes and these are their capitals and. Uh-huh. I remember, you know, at some point in my schooling realizing like, oh, it wasn't always like that. You know, we had territories. And then before that, there weren't even any kind of lines on this map at one point in time.
Yeah.
Super fascinating. Well, an act that spelled disaster for some Americans was an unimaginable opportunity for others. In total, over 60,000 individuals would respond to the call by the Lincoln administration for free land in Idaho, eventually settling over 18% of the state. These settlers were drawn to opportunity, adventure, dreams of land ownership that were out of reach in the old world, and the economic potential of farming, mining, and the untamed West. So many were new to the difficulties of homesteading, from the natural obstacles like severe conditions, lack of building materials, scarce water and heat, plagues, and even insects. And so to the lawless and the lonely nature of the early development, making very few newcomers prepared for this well-suited task.
So what is the catch? How can they just give away land for free? Is there what are the rules, I guess, is the better question.
The string.
Yeah. So enacted during the Civil War in 1862, the Homestead Act granted any adult citizen or intended citizen who had never borne arms against the United States government the opportunity to claim 160 acres of surveyed government land.
Who had never borne arms against the United States government.
No traitors.
Yes. Significant words, considering 1862, the height of the American Civil War.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have not yet found proof that this was specifically intended as a political or military strategy, but it does make sense that some people who might have been on the fence about joining the Confederate Army could have been dissuaded from joining up by the prospect of remaining eligible for free land through the Homestead Act. Homesteading legislation had actually been proposed in Congress as early as the 1830s, but it was always met by strong opposition from Southern representatives because so one reason I saw mentioned was that a large quantity of small landholders in the West who were like farming agricultural lands out West could conceivably threaten some of the Southern landholders' hold on certain economic markets. But by 1862, once enough of the Southern states had seceded from the Union, the much revised homesteading legislation easily passed the House and Senate because there were fewer representatives in general. And all of the ones who had been strongly opposed were now part of another country, essentially.
Yeah.
So another key component was that they had to actively live on the 160 acres and improve their plot through means of cultivation of some sort of crop. So this was called proving up, and it was a process of proving to the authorities, which the closest general land office, ours was in Coeur d'Alene at the time, that you have tamed your land by showing evidence of residence. So basically by building a permanent dwelling, farming a productive crop in the soil on the certain percentage of land, and then after 5 years, the homesteader earned the title to the property. Their only expense was paying modest fees. So that was an original $10 filing fee and a $4 application to the commission. It's just hard to imagine because all I can get out of my garden is like a salad. And would that be enough? I'd be like, here, would the dressing help?
And, you know, like today, roughly kind of multiply by 10. So we're looking at $100 filing fee, $40 application commission. Yeah. Like, I think I would jump on that if it was available.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. And the full-time job, too, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. Exactly. I'm going to ask about that later if you really would do that. And stop me if I'm asking a question that you intend to ask later on. But does this – You I imagine, have to apply right away before you build your house.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so then you build the house and they check back in 5 years.
Yeah. And so the wild thing, though, is that you might be living in New Jersey or Ohio, and then you have to come out here to Coeur d'Alene, file your petition, and then you can go to the land, which you've never seen before.
Yeah.
And then you live there for 5 years. You have to come back to the office in Coeur d'Alene, and then you can get the deed to it. So these were not people. This isn't like you see a house on Zillow and you're like, ooh, that looks nice. I have enough cash. Here's my deposit.
Maybe the molding wasn't real, but
you have no idea what you're getting into.
My gosh.
Right. There must be some horror stories of people who thought they were getting one thing and they show up and it's a vertical piece of property or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it's a great piece of land except for there's these five huge rocks in the, you know, taking up most of it. Or
right.
Like that.
And like they said, they were really trying to get people to farm out West. And so they were surveying what they considered suitable agricultural lots. So they weren't really surveying and selling the mountainous areas.
You mentioned that in the article.
But even when you're driving around like the Selly Valley up here, there are areas where there are maybe 40-foot cliffs.
Yeah.
Or, these really kind of steep ravines going down to the creek or something like that. So there were definitely obstacles. And there were also a lot of trees because there were very few natural like prairie areas in Bonner County at that time.
Yeah.
Can't even imagine. So over the course of the Homestead Act's tenure, more than 160 million acres of public land, or nearly 10% of the total area of the United States, was given away to homesteaders. So most of the homesteads located west of the Mississippi River. So that kind of puts it in perspective. A total of 2 million people applied for claims, but only about 40% of them ultimately proved up the land. Wow, that's an interesting percentage.
It is. Mm-hmm. High failure rate.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
I wonder what the divorce rate was, too.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting that you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. With only the intent of future citizenship as a requirement, European immigrants comprised a notable percentage of homesteaders. Although the act afforded the opportunity of land prosperity to any U.S. citizen or intended citizen, there were, of course, exceptions. Agricultural workers, which is ironic because they were trying to send people out here to do agricultural work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Agricultural workers and domestic servants, occupations predominantly held by African-American, Mexican, and Asian populations, were excluded from the prospect of affordable land cultivation and ownership under the Homestead Act. And under the terms of the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which did affect this area because that was kind of the decade when we were primarily being homesteaded.
Mm-hmm.
So under the Chinese Exclusion Act, Chinese were ineligible for citizenship and thus could not apply for homesteads. However, married women were also exempt, but single, widowed, divorced, or deserted women were eligible.
Well, that is interesting.
Uh-huh.
So do we know if many women applied for homestead claims in North Idaho?
Well, that's a great question. So it was certainly used, but it's hard to say if it was more or less common here in other places. It was not uncommon for the wives of railroad construction workers or timbermen to become widowed.
Mm.
And the Homestead Act was, for the hardiest of them, a sort of safety net. So they could continue pursuing their 160 acres without their husband, instead of them and their children getting evicted off the land.
Oh, sure. Okay. So if you're out here and your husband falls down that cliff on your property and dies, you're not out of luck.
I've been watching too many like late night murder mysteries, but uh-huh. I can imagine like the oopsies uh-huh. of like the cliff or a drowning.
There were a lot of accounts of women who just went nuts. Like, they're like, why are we here? I can't deal with this.
Mm-hmm. Cabin fever.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, literally.
That's what they call it.
Yeah. And I think, uh-huh. like, when you're looking at the national picture, there was a lot of that, of just like, you're living mm-hmm. in the wilderness yeah. and it's so hard. But up here, we have some remarkable accounts, maybe a decade after the trains were here, of women who were just like, yeah, I'm here. I have my business. Right. I have my farm. I'm
super
content
formidable.
To figure it out.
Very inspiring. And it was less common for deserted or single women to pursue a land claim, but legally possible. And even though married women couldn't file a claim themselves, they could double their husband's claim to 320 acres instead of 160.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so by being a couple, by being a married couple, you can double your claim.
Yes.
But if you're an individual, you can't.
Yeah. Right. It would be owned by the man.
Owned by the man. Huh.
Yeah. Feels like the board game of life.
Yeah.
Which card?
Okay. Well, it would be hard to enforce that eviction law anyway, mm-hmm. I think, if a woman was on the land and homesteading it.
Enforcement in general was a little mm-hmm. shaky. So later, by the early 1900s, the task of inspecting homesteads, and this would have been once they started kind of selling off land in national, in forested areas. So they would actually have U.S. Forest Service rangers go around on their horses, kind of taking notes on how the homesteaders' progress was going. And they'd be like, oh, well, you only have half an acre planted and we're 3 years in. I don't know if you're going to cut it. And they would go back and report to the head office. But in the late 1800s, the Forest Service was not yet established, and there were only so many officials from the General Land Office who probably thought it was a lot nicer of a day to just sit in the office and file paperwork than to go spend a week on horseback riding up to the middle of nowhere. So
yeah,
these horseback trips to check in were not common.
Yeah. Huh. So we don't, you just come in and you say, Yeah, it's doing great.
Yeah.
You know, corn's coming up.
Right. Yeah. And this was also like the period of time where, so Wyatt Earp, he was one of the famous cowboys, right? Okay. Yes. So he was at one point the kind of the sheriff of North Idaho. But his district was from, I believe, from the Canadian border all the way down through the Silver Valley.
Oh, wow.
And so in terms of law and order and enforcement and that kind of thing, these guys were in charge of this just like enormous area. Mm-hmm. And so they were really going after, you know, people who were mining and murdering each other. That's kind of what they were focused on more than telling someone they had not planted enough
corn.
Yeah,
it's not yellow enough. Mm-hmm. And the homesteaders who followed the rules were not always the ones rewarded for their integrity. Special interest groups like military, missionaries, timber barons, railroad companies, and even prospectors, ranchers, or squatters could supersede an individual's homesteader's claim. So squatters, particularly in the Northwest, were often rewarded for their tenacity and perseverance through some resorted to intimidation or threats to run off homesteaders and take their claims after all of the hard work was nearly done. Okay, so the schemes are propping up
here. Yeah. And this is a little bit later, but I know you know the story well of Ella Mae Farman.
Oh, yeah.
And the man who kept kind of creeping around.
The man.
The cabin.
Maybe the hermit.
Maybe. Of Schweitzer.
Schweitzer. Yes. Yeah, isn't that Schweitzer?
Yeah.
That's the Schweitzer story.
Yeah. The legend got, you know, started, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't that his kind of goal was to scare them enough to move off of their, out of their cabin?
Yeah.
And kind of take that nice cozy cabin they'd built.
Absolutely.
For
yeah.
Yeah. So another short sighted.
Jack is like, tell me. Wait.
No, go ahead. Where were we? Continue.
Uh-huh. Another short sighted aspect of the Homestead Act was its application of these sort of blanket rules that did not easily apply equally to all parts of the country. So 160 acres of, say, like river-adjacent land in Ohio might be 10 times easier to cultivate than 160 acres of old-growth, damp cedar forest in North Idaho or 160 acres of rocky, dry soil in southern Idaho. However, because cultivation of the land was a key requirement to prove up, homesteaders would get creative with their crops because all they had to do was prove that they could grow something. Mm-hmm. Some people moved west with pockets full of every type of seed they could collect and tried planting a little bit of everything in between the stumps of the trees that they cut down. Others quickly realized how well apples and other fruit trees grow in our climate and cultivated their lands with extensive orchards, the last remains of some of which can actually still be seen today, which is really cool.
That's incredible. The lure of homesteading attracted immigration, encouraged the growth of communities, and increased taxable property. But turning a homestead into a profitable enterprise was a difficult task. The money to support life on the homestead often came from the sources of employment, like logging and millwork. And, of course, the railroad would bring many workers who remained in the area and filed for homesteads. Okay, so this kind of dispels my comment like, oh, well, that was a full-time job. No, it wasn't. They had to do that and work, too.
Well, and this is why from what I've seen, it seemed more common in our area that people who filed for homesteads were bringing a family with them. So it wasn't necessarily the young single men who were doing railroad work and then having to go home and build a cabin and plant their yard. It was like maybe the husband did work in logging, but then he had a wife and, you know, four or five kids who were all really focused on the homestead. So like as a family, maybe they would get the cabin built so everybody had a place to live, and then maybe the dad would be helping with the farm on the weekends, mm-hmm. but like the mom and kids would really be kind of the ones developing that plot and taking care of it while he's at work making money so they can get the milk or whatever mm-hmm. kind of things they had to buy.
In the years before the first railroad came through here, so before 1882, people were living here already mm-hmm. and able to travel around the lake and rivers by steamboat.
Yes.
So were people able to get homestead claims right down to the water, or how else would they have gotten around?
Mm. Well, that's a great question. There were small towns at Ponderay City, where Farragut State Park is now.
Ah, that's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then remember how amazing, mm-hmm. well, still today, but mm-hmm. Hope and other mm-hmm. tiny towns were around the lake. So before the railroad came through, Sandpoint really didn't exist. Some homestead sites were near the water, but it was risky to plant crops because of flooding, because mm-hmm. you know, we didn't have the dams and the control there. So many people staked out claims off the water. This is when you started to see rough wagon roads cut out of the woods. And it's mm-hmm. fascinating because when you look at the legal lots of record, especially along the lake, they extend way far out into mm-hmm. the lake. And you wonder, like, how does that make sense? Well, it's due, like, it all changed over time.
Mm-hmm. Right, before the yeah. dams were in place to control.
Yeah. Exactly.
The water, yeah.
So the attractive lake property that we would mm-hmm. all love to have today with our wonderful mm-hmm. ski boats and everything wasn't really what it was back then, mm-hmm. you know, because of the hazard of that water body right beside.
Yeah. The dams changed everything because they kind of, like, the dams took land that could mm-hmm. have otherwise been farmed, maybe. But they also protect it now from those bigger floods. So there was a huge flood in 1894 mm-hmm. that a lot of these early settlers would have experienced. And I don't, we'll have to get into that. I don't know how it impacted their actual homestead.
It's incredible to think about, like, all of the hazards. So you have people that are trying to take your property, the squatters. Mm-hmm. You've got fires.
Yeah.
You have flooding. It's
kind of just like the brutal winters.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The weather alone.
Yeah.
We've never done a show on the floods, the various historical floods, have we? I don't think so.
We should do like a whole natural disaster series.
That's a good idea. Okay.
Depressing.
All right. Tuck that away for a later date. Let's continue with our homestead conversation. If you're building a cabin on one of these sites, what would that cabin have looked like?
Mm. So the cabin was the first and most important structure you had to build. Not only because it was a requirement of the homestead claim. There was a relatively short window of time to build a cabin before winter set in, and you did not want to be stuck in North Idaho in the winter without a warm and dry place to sleep.
I was thinking about that just this morning.
I know.
Think
about when the power goes out today and uh-huh. you don't have heat for, you know, 24 hours. And it's
people
like,
just lose their mind.
Yeah, it's so hard. And just imagine that for 8 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. It's good. I mean, it was 14 degrees at my house this morning. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, and it gets colder than that too, but that was just this morning. And I knew we were going to be talking about the Homestead Act. And I was thinking, what if I hadn't quite finished the cabin, you know, that fall,
right?
Like, what, if, you know, yeah. and it, mm-hmm. and we got a really hard, mm-hmm. well, the winter came in early or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. We, mm-hmm. so we have a log cabin at the museum, mm-hmm. and in 1980, they transported it from its original site over on Shingle Mill mm-hmm. to the museum. And I feel like this, what happened was kind of like indicative of all of the problems that could happen with this process. So this is 1980.
Yeah.
A bunch of volunteers take this log cabin apart.
Uh-huh.
They label everything with chalk. They're like, here's A, B, C, D.
Archival process.
Here's uh-huh. how we put it back together. They take it to the museum. And then for whatever reason, maybe the weather had already turned bad.
Yeah.
They don't assemble it until the next spring. And so then they come back in the spring and realize all of the chalk has washed off of the logs, and now they just have to figure out how to put it back together.
It's and like so, not labeling the drawers of the dresser.
Exactly. So just think of like that's something that, you know, people were still kind of like, oh, dang, we made a big mistake. And this is 100 years after these original pioneers were coming in and having to figure this out. But the timeline, the weather, everything was higher stakes at that point in time.
Okay, so the cabin.
Yeah, so typically a cabin would be around like roughly 12 by 16 feet, maybe somewhere in that range, though some could be larger. Most homesteaders built a cabin out of rough log timbers, and after they had proved up and had acquired the deed to their land, they would then invest in building larger homes that were often of milled lumber. So say you build your log cabin, it's very rough, and then a decade later you have your deed, you've saved up some money. Maybe there are some lumber mills in the area at the time, and you can actually get those you know, like 1x12s milled to build the house at this point. Log cabins were an attractive first dwelling because they require very few tools and they don't require any nails to construct, which could be expensive and hard to make. Yeah, so nails, you know, they're metal. They have to be forged in some way. And so... kind of a difficult commodity to find out in the middle of nowhere. Which made log cabins much easier to build.
It's funny just because nowadays it would be so much harder to make a log cabin. To cut down the logs and build it than it would be just to go pick
finding
up some nails.
Finding timber that big is now the scarce commodity.
I think the expectation was different too. Like, our chinking that we expect today was a lot different than the chinking that they did.
Yeah, definitely. Again, with the log cabin at the museum, Heather, you led that in 2021. We did a restoration of that. And part of it was to chink all, to like re-chink the gaps.
Roof.
And I remember, you know, making, you know, watching them mix the kind of Portland cement to fill in between the logs and having to learn how to scrape it in and at what angle. And it's like, at this point in time, they've sort of dialed that process in. But back then, again, like winter's coming, you're just kind of throwing mud at the wall, literally.
I mean, you have your kids doing it. Like, really pack that hole.
Exactly. Whatever you could find got shoved in there to just keep the wind out. So another thing that's really interesting to me is that immigrants from different European countries would bring different building techniques with them, leading to a variety of interesting construction methods across Bonner County. So one in particular that I think of is over by the town of Cabinet, which is it's no longer really a town, but it was across the river from Clark Fork back in the day. And there was a big Finnish community there. And they had a very specific way that they constructed log cabins. And there are still a couple of those original buildings standing in Cabinet down there. So you can kind of see how log cabins would have been built in Finland and how that technology and knowledge was brought over here, is just so cool.
In Cabinet.
Yes.
I'm gonna go find it.
It's very cool. So probably the easiest thing would be to look up the fish hatchery. Over by Clark Fork. And that will take you to the vicinity of where Cabinet used to be.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
That's that was actually what I was gonna ask next is, other than the one at the museum, which we know was moved and rebuilt, are there any of the you know, log cabins of this kind of era that are still standing?
There are. And I will tell you more about those in a few minutes.
You'll tell me more in a few minutes. Okay.
It's amazing.
Yes. Once I remember where they are.
To be able to actually see them firsthand.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I'll have a lot of friends come up to me and they've purchased properties and they're like, do you know about the old so-and-so school or, you know, the first homesteading? And there are a lot of people that have properties with kind of a structure that still remains that has historical significance, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. So construction in general would mm-hmm. not have ended with that initial cabin. So that was all that was required to fulfill the requirements of the Homestead Act. But you would usually then go on to build a barn, maybe a corral for your horses, if you were lucky to have horses, a fenced-in garden. So, you know, just like today, so the deer couldn't jump in and eat all of your food. Mm-hmm. You might be building a smokehouse for smoking fish, or, you know, other kind of bins to store the crops that you were raising on your property.
Hmm. What would life have been like for those early settlers before, you know, the infrastructure arrived of, when it was just those very earliest people here. Can you tell us kind of what that would have been like?
Yeah, so let's kind of take away all of our modern conveniences that we can think of today. mm-hmm. So first of all, heating the home. You have, like, let's say a wood stove. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to gather the fuel for that. So you have a schedule of making sure that you have wood, like, already to go. Mm-hmm. So that's logging down trees, making sure that, you know, everything's split, mm-hmm. Stacked so it doesn't go moldy, and then making sure throughout the day that the wood stove is maintained.
Mm-hmm. I recently learned how to light a wood stove, I was very proud mm-hmm. of myself. And then I remember calling I was on the phone with my friend, and I was like, I've gotten so good at lighting this wood stove, but I just don't know how to, like, keep it going. It just, like, burns out. And she was like, did you add more wood to it? I was like, oh, right.
I love
That's
it.
That's the key.
I think, like, a true telesign. So we have, like, supplementary, like, cadet heaters, mm-hmm. but we are primary wood heat at our mm-hmm. place. And a sign of that would be, like, how many scars you have on your arm from accidentally touching the top, uh-huh. you know, the vertical, like, white lines. We put ours in 2012. And so, like, every hour I have an internal clock. It's like, put two or three more pieces on, you know, mm-hmm. and then we have the conversation before we go to bed, like, do you think we should put a little bit more on? Because then you also regulating the heat. Mm-hmm. So it's colder on the bottom levels, but where the kids are up above, like where you can, like, it's like a hot house.
Yeah. So you've got the pioneer mindset. Yeah. You've got that pioneer internal clock.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
like, think of how advanced the wood stoves of today probably are compared 100%. To what they were using then.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, most definitely. So then you have, like, preparing the food. And so thinking, like, would that be cooked on the stove? Probably. So how do you bake bread mm-hmm. on the stove and, you know, make sure just, like, getting the heat regulated enough to cook anything? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, you know, the Trader Joe's. I'm thinking about, like, what my night was last night, like, uh-huh. grab the frozen food and add a stick of butter and go for it.
This like makes me think of, you know, how if you're looking at recipes written today, they're so dialed in. It's like, adjust your fancy equipment to 385 degrees, whatever. But when you look at your great grandmother's recipes, it's like, mix this stuff, cook it. It's like, exactly. It seems like it was a much more intuitive process at that time. Mm-hmm.
And then, so speaking of no refrigeration, getting water even, like hauling the water. And then on top of that, you have, like, making your clothes, educating your children, keeping them busy. You know, mm-hmm. it's like the layers are just so incredible.
Yeah. And then, like, how do you time chores at different times of day so that you're maximizing the daylight? When is it worth lighting a candle? Because mm-hmm. that's a precious commodity too. Or, you know, burning an oil lamp, and what's the fire risk of that? And
the hero of the schedule, essentially. And I don't think, like, people today are, like, yearning to be out recreating. I think your everyday life was a recreation. So to be able to, like, take a pause and not be working was kind of the beauty of it, right? Mm-hmm. At the rest. And to some degree, you weren't having to constantly entertain your children, right? Because mm-hmm. there was no downtime. It was, you know, you were always trying to kind of keep everything going. That was the full-time job.
So your mm-hmm. rocking chair might be like your prize possession.
Right.
Because it represents the prospect of rest.
Exactly. Reading the book.
Hmm. It makes me wonder, yeah, when was the first time somebody like ran, just decided, I'm going to go for a run for pleasure?
But I still don't understand.
I've never done it in my life, but I just, you know, when's the first time somebody said, like, have too much, I got nothing going on, I'm just going to go running.
People would think they were nuts.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah, they're working
go
hard.
Go chop
to,
some
like,
wood if you got too much energy.
Keep like, the... Yeah. To sustain the food, you know, that they had to survive.
Hold on to that energy. Yeah.
So thinking of like leisure activity, then I think what they would do is take their chores and then like weave in the leisure of that. So like hunting and fishing. Mm-hmm. Maybe mm-hmm. they had a moment they could go recreate on the beach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Although it probably wasn't. I mean, there was no snack shack there at
right.
the time.
That's true. So we have like playing cards and different games together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that looked a little different sometimes in the saloons versus around the table.
Yes.
So this is family time.
Yes.
We're going to keep it to that. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of picnics, though, and different like civic gatherings. Being a part of fraternal organizations was really important. Mm-hmm. So then... There'd be the dances on steamboats. Mm-hmm. You had the organized sports.
Yeah.
And the mm-hmm. general carousing.
Yeah, that's for the non-family time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Carousing.
Back to the saloon. Okay. I love that word.
That's a word that covers a lot, I guess. Carousing. Yeah.
That's a Hannah word that she brought uh-huh. for.
Uh-huh. But yeah, just like how do you enjoy? I think of like the hunting and fishing as someone who's like, maybe they go out and they're like, I just need to go for a walk in the woods. And mm-hmm. then they're on the way back and they're like, I can't show up empty handed. So they like shoot a squirrel or they like catch mm-hmm. one fish and bring it back. They're like, I don't know, tough day out there.
Yeah. mm-hmm. Oh, so this description from the Lindstrom family paints a pretty good picture of what life would have been like. So they arrived in Sandpoint in 1892. After procuring a rowboat, they started for their new home. So they built it. So it was a homestead that was 4.5 miles west of Sandpoint, farther by river, finding it impossible to make the entire trip in daylight. They landed about the Dover area and spent the night under some bushes. There were no real roads at the time, only a trail which followed the river and lake to Chuck Slough. So the homestead was heavily wooded, so a small sawmill was brought there and operated while the timber lasted. So in 1900s, a large log house was erected with still stands. There were no railroads in those early days.
The large log house was built in 1900. Mm-hmm. They got there in 1892.
Yeah.
So 8 years. Before they
built the nice house.
The nice house,
Living under bushes. Do we know how many people were in their family?
I don't know. So this is something we should dig into mm-hmm. more. There's kind of this like random collection of papers. It looks like they were notes taken during interviews with some of the pioneer families. Probably around the time that the museum was getting started, so in the 1970s. Mm. I was trying to decipher them last night, but the handwriting's kind of all over the place. Mm-hmm. So this was one that I was able to kind of like transcribe. I think we need to get our cursive experts in to kind of transcribe the rest of those and see what other stories we might have. But yeah, mm-hmm. that does give you a good idea that they probably built some kind of log cabin, but then it took 8 years before they built like a permanent house that they would have lived in for decades.
And at the time that the note was taken, the house was still standing.
Yes. So in the 70s, probably.
Okay. Yeah. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it's still there. Of course, it's on private property, so this is not, we can't really go hunting it out.
Exactly.
Yeah, but 4.5 miles west of Sandpoint.
Yeah.
People with binoculars are like,
yeah.
Now,
do not go out there.
Back to you. You were asking earlier about whether there are any cabins you can see today, and there are a few. I'm actually excited. This is going to be the subject of our next History Mystery article in Sandpoint Magazine. The trick to being able to see one, though, is finding land that was once part of a private homestead that is now viewable on public property.
Mm-hmm.
There are a handful of them on lands close to our waterways that were reclaimed during the dam building period of the mid-20th century.
Yeah.
So a lot of those, like we were saying, there were homesteads that kind of extended into what is now the lake, and maybe that land by the water was used for farming some type of grass or hay or that kind of thing. But then when they built the dams, they kind of took a lot of that land back and made it U.S. government land as part of the Army Corps area. So there are still some homestead cabins in those areas. There is an old cabin on just off the trail at Trout Creek, which is really cool. That's an easy one that you can walk to. There is the foundation of a dwelling at Odin Bay, which is on another trail area. And one of my favorites is there is still some evidence of a homestead orchard on Strong's Island. And that is an island in the middle of the Pendre River, just west of Priest River. So if you're out on a boat on the Pendre River, at the west end of that island, you can see there's still sort of a clearing area that has some old fruit trees on it. And if you look at the, like on Google Maps or something, if you look at the maps, you can still kind of see the area where the cabin would have been.
That's incredible.
So
I want to check that out.
There are preservation efforts going on with the state and federal level with the State Historic Preservation Office. There are different programs where it's just to catalog like historic homesteads, historic barns, anything that has like cultural significance. Mm-hmm. So those are things to think about. And it'd be fun to kind of do like a call out. It's like if you have a historic structure, you know, and want to know more about it, it's a great.
You're right.
The museum could definitely help support
you
in finding out more about your early structure on your property.
Yeah. I mean, even in the last 10 years that I've lived here, there are some beautiful old barns that have come down that were probably over 100 years old. So we lose them as time goes by. And yeah, if we can at least document them before they fall apart, it's saving a little piece of history.
One thing that's kind of interesting with that, we live in a culture now where this is an unfortunate part, but materials are so expensive, like real wood, right? Mm-hmm. But also people want the history and they want the soul. So I have seen specifically in this community, when old historic structures are coming down, people are salvaging all the materials that they can to get the kind of heritage, cultural, like, you know, wood. And because I mean, you go to Home Depot and there's people that have created companies just to age wood to make them look more historic. Yeah. So that is kind of a shining light. Like as these structures are falling down, they are being repurposed into new ones and carrying on the soul. And that is something that they did, you know, in the 1900s as well. Right.
Don't waste anything.
Yes. It's very sustainable.
Yeah. Okay, before we move on to what's coming up next, do you think, how would you have done if you were arrived here in eight? Would you really have wanted to be a homesteader?
I would have hated it.
No.
What's
the earliest that you think you could have arrived and actually pulled it off?
I don't know. I like reading too much.
Yeah.
I'd be that kid who was like growing up on the homestead, just like running away with my book, like, I'm gonna go find firewood, and I'm just hiding out in the woods reading. The earliest, I don't know. There was a big, like, between 1900 and 1915, that's kind of when Sandpoint at least became sort of a modern town.
Right.
So I think any time after 1915, you would have had like most of the kind of modern day conveniences available.
Yeah. Yeah. The railroad was here. So things were able to get here. Yeah.
I bet you could have cut it out in the wilderness, Heather.
I do like to do projects. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that would be hardest on me would be the loneliness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as I love my husband and the kids, mm-hmm. like having that be the only like interaction, I think, mm-hmm. you know, for months at a time would be very difficult.
Yeah.
For them too to be around mm-hmm. me as that long.
Yeah. So maybe when radios came in and yeah. you could like get your news, hear exactly. stories.
There we
the
go.
Isolation, mm-hmm. you know, I think could be very, very challenging.
Yeah. Okay.
How about you, Jack?
In your 20s? I don't know. I think I could have done it, but I'm not really sure. It sounds pretty miserable.
Now, stereotypes. Would you mm-hmm. be logging, mining, or?
I would have to be logging, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing is I'm not a very good planter. Like I like to think that I could come out here and make a, you know, make a log cabin. I think that would be fun. Mm-hmm. But as far as growing crops and stuff, right. I have no idea what I'm doing. I mean, and I don't think I can figure that out. I have no natural touch for it anyway. In the garden, it's tricky. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. We do have a garden, but I'm not great at it. Yeah. Personally.
So fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Tell us about in our remaining few minutes. Okay. What are we going to talk about next time? When we regroup, when we meet again.
Yeah. Well, we might see if we can find any personal accounts of mm-hmm. people homesteading in this area early on. I don't know exactly where we'll fit that in. But after that, mm-hmm. I think it would make sense to go back and talk a little bit about the travel by water,
mm-hmm.
how people got around before the railroad. And we touched on this a bit with the Mary Moody and the first steamboats that were on the lake, but that was really in pursuit of gold mm-hmm. in the 1860s. Yeah. So did those steamboats stick around? How did the use of them shift after the gold was all gone? And for the early people who were here, you know, were they cutting those wagon roads out of the woods, or were they traveling by boat? How did they get around?
Indeed.
Yeah.
That'll be next time on the second and fourth Monday of every month. So that'll be our next episode. What's coming up here locally? If you're listening to us live, it's Monday, January 26th. So what's coming up in early February?
Yeah, at the museum, we have our next Free First Saturday on February 7th from 10 to 2. Admission is free at the museum on that day, and our education team is also hosting hands-on history activities. Those are free kids' crafts or projects where they get to kind of experience some of the things that you might have experienced as a pioneer child. So it's a lot of fun, and that will be, again, Saturday, February 7th from 10 to 2. We're also excited. We're going to be having some events going on during Winter Carnival. Our curator, Olivia Fee, is opening a new exhibit called For the Record, How Journalists, Surveyors, and Photographers Shaped History as We Know It Today. And we're also hoping to do an adventurous walking tour of the Pend'Oreille Bay Trail. And we will be showing the Centennial film again. So that'll be a little bit later on in February, but looking forward to being a part of Winter Carnival this year.
Okay. A Bay Trail walking tour in February.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's so fun.
That's great. Okay. Hey, you're listening to 88.5 KRFY Pend'Oreille. Bird note in just a couple minutes. Heather, anything to mention? What's coming up?
One thing I'm working on, I'm on the Bonner General Health Foundation board, and we are busy right now getting ready for the annual Heart Ball, mm-hmm. which is super fun. This year's theme is Through the Looking Glass.
Perfect for you.
I know, right? Anytime I can do Alice in Wonderland. So that's been incredibly fun. Tickets are available on the Bonner General website. So I encourage everybody to, participate, go online, buy a table, get a ticket. It's an incredibly fun February event to attend, and it certainly is an important one supporting our hospital.
Well, okay. Thanks for listening to 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio, and this has been the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson, Hannah Combs of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. Thank you.
Thank you.
Heather Upton, Director Emeritus. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So fun.
Okay. On to Bird Note and then Otto's Eclectic Mix here on Panhandle Community Radio.